I read all the best Bitcoin content out there so that you can listen. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read with Guy Swan. Welcome back to the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. That is me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are finishing up. We have two more pieces left, and they are both amazing. In the Bitcoin Times second edition, and we are getting very close to the end here, and today's piece is another by Nick Carter. We have read numerous pieces by Nick Carter on this show, and they are always absolute fire, and this one does not break the trend. Today, we are reading from the Bitcoin Times second edition by Nick Carter, "The cat is out of the bag." The cat is out of the bag. Bitcoin is everyone's problem now. Evie.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. But what of the man? I know his name was Guy Fawkes. And I know in 1605 he attempted to blow up the Houses of Parliament. But who was he really? What was he like? We are told to remember the idea, not the man. Because a man can fail. He can be caught. He can be killed and forgotten. But 400 years later, an idea can still change the world. I've witnessed firsthand the power of ideas. I've seen people kill in the name of them and die defending them. But you cannot kiss an idea, cannot touch it or hold it. Ideas do not bleed. They do not feel pain. They do not love.
Evie Hammond, V for Vendetta. An exorbitant privilege. Bitcoin is first and foremost a monetary phenomenon. The social climbers and false prophets who proclaimed it is a payments revolution have either come around or been repudiated by the market and washed out, embittered. Most who understood it that way are now moving on to new things. The world did not need another PayPal. The world needed a new monetary institution. As Bitcoin went from a proof of concept, to a toy, to a joke, to a collectible, and then to a movement, a few policymakers came to realize that it posed a threat to the established system. Not because of its present form, but because what it represented. A profane insult to the carefully calibrated monetary system, all done in a mocking, insouciant fashion, a band of nerds and ne'er-do-wells insolently challenging the state's monopoly on seigniorage. Satire is what despots fear most, and the rise of Bitcoin made our present monetary system look patently absurd. Critic. Nothing backs Bitcoin. Bitcoiner. What backs the dollar? Critic. Nothing intrinsically. Our ability to compel foreign nations to accept our currency as the numeraire of international trade, our ability to force citizens to pay taxes in dollars, and our military assets required to enforce both conditions. Bitcoiner. How persuasive. The visceral hatred elites feel about Bitcoin? Perfectly justified. How else would you react to an upstart aimed at usurping your sacred monetary privilege? Such is the potency of Bitcoin that it compels the high priests of U.S. imperialism to reveal the unwritten rules about the role the dollar plays in power projection abroad. In May of this year, U.S. Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat from California, spoke out against cryptocurrency on the floor of the House. His statement laid bare the normally veiled post-Bretton Woods doctrine in which the dollar is employed not only as a monetary tool, but a strategic one too. Quote, "An awful lot of our international power comes from the fact that the dollar is the standard unit of international finance. And it is the announced purpose of the supporters of cryptocurrency to take that power away from us. whether it is to disempower our foreign policy, our tax collection, or our traditional law enforcement. The purpose of cryptocurrency is solely to aid in the disempowerment of the United States and the rule of law. End quote. Representative Sherman is practically a soothsayer. He understands precisely where the world is going. His mistake is not in the diagnosis, but in the cure. He mistakenly believes that Bitcoin can be reckoned with. But Bitcoin is an idea, not a product. The notion of a weightless virtual commodity was productized for good in 2009, although the idea long predated Bitcoin, and it has been eroding the state's monetary monopoly ever since. It could not have been created at a better time. One wonders how Bitcoin would have fared if it had been created in the 1980s or 90s, when the U.S. economy was fairer, the monetary system was totally unquestioned, and the U.S. was the sole dominant global superpower. Against today's backdrop, Bitcoin insists on itself. It has urgency. In the halcyon days of Pax Americana, Bitcoin would have mattered much less. In the twilight of the American empire, however, it is more relevant than ever. Our monetary system is disastrously redistributive. The wealth of political elites derives primarily from privileged access to the monetary spigot. This is no longer a secret. The heavenly manna of seigniorage has opened, first a trickle and now a flood. The world is grappling with inequality, and the dozens of populist revolts active in the world today are patent evidence of this. Yet, the resurgent socialist parties misdiagnose the situation. The enemy is not a nebulous form of capitalism, but rather a form of socialism itself, a low-rates-fueled perma-bailout to the owners of financial assets. It's no coincidence that asset prices have steadfastly risen in the last decade as the Fed has embarked on a ludicrously unshackled period of money creation. Many ask, against the backdrop of monetary issuance, where did the inflation go? It went, of course, into financial assets, but this benefits the paltry few. Did you know that the decade-long rally in the S&P 500 has been characterized by historically low participation from retail investors? The riotous gains in asset prices have sidelined mom and pop. They accrue instead to institutional investors and corporate insiders who returned capital to themselves through buybacks. In the 90s, Wharton MBAs convinced investors that the ideal mode of corporate governance was making large equity and options grants to corporate directors to create incentive alignment. Well, the grants were made, and the directors rewarded the shareholders by spending corporate earnings on buying back the stock, thus juicing earnings per share and triggering options payouts for directors. They just so happened to forget to generate corporate value along the way. That pesky real economy? That was secondary. Why are politicians so rich? Why do they become rich after leaving office? Why do regulators go work in industry? Why is the Secretary of the Treasury a former Goldman banker and hedge fund manager? Why are renters historically disempowered, whereas landowners are historically privileged? Why has the cost of higher education and healthcare outpaced inflation by orders of magnitude? Why is the CPI a sad, pathetic joke? Do consumer goods account for most of your expenditures, or does rent, healthcare, and education? What are you more exposed to, the cost of a TV or property values? Even if you didn't know what the Cantillon effect was, you felt it vividly in the last decade. The hopelessness felt by many in today's society is the consequence of this monetary misalignment, the introduction of eye-watering money into the economy, but an uneven distribution. Who benefited from historically low rates? Normal folks dealing with predatory credit card loans? or owners of financial assets who were able to put historically cheap capital to work. And no, cheap financing didn't help the middle and lower class get a foothold in property, because property values were horrendously inflated in the first place. Property, treated as a store of value for the rich, is precisely where so many of the Fed's newly minted dollars settled. Reflect on those hollowed-out city centers in Vancouver, New York, and London, full of empty houses used as capital warehouses for absentee millionaires. If there's a single graph that evidences the impact of a decade of freewheeling monetary stimulus on the economy, it is the following. Fed chart on the velocity of the M2 money stock showing a precipitous decline since the late 90s and early 2000s. Monetary velocity in the U.S. is at its lowest since modern records began. If you think about the equation of exchange, MV equals PQ, a decline in V, velocity, is sufficient to offset an increasing money supply, M, to keep prices, P, stable. And that's just about what happened. The purchasing power of the dollar has remained relatively stable even as supply has expanded dramatically. Where is the inflation? Is the common refrain, but the question should instead be, where has the new money supply gone? It is clear that it has settled, inert and unproductive, in financial assets mostly owned by the ultra-rich, bidding them up to century highs in relative valuation terms. This is why our perverse form of zombie capitalism is often referred to as socialism for the rich. If you can position yourself close enough to the money spigot and arrange to share in the spoils of the monetary redistribution, you can profit handsomely. If you have access to financial assets and can benefit from a low cost of capital, whether you are an investor or a corporate director with discretion over buybacks, you can make low rates and quantitative easing work for you. If you cannot, you are utterly frozen out of the system, and indeed disadvantaged, as pricier capital assets immiserate the non-rentier class. Bitcoin is a system that explicitly rejects identity. Critics often ask who exactly Bitcoin is for. This is perhaps a misspecified question. Bitcoin does not serve a who or a subset of whos. It just serves, indifferent to its end users. Bitcoin, by design, does not require identity data to work. Your counterparty could be on the OFAC sanctions list. They could be a sentient toad or a few lines of code. Bitcoin has no way of knowing, nor does it care. The only requirement to send a payment is to provide a valid signature which meets the criteria sufficient to unencumber a UTXO. Traditional payment and credit relationships, on the other hand, enshrine identity. My credit card company is very interested in knowing that it is me who is using the card. If I inform them that a stranger has absconded with my card, they consider all the spends post-theft totally invalid. The call with the fraud department goes like this. Can you vouch for the $10.51 purchase on 224 at Chipotle? Yes, that was me, extra guac. Can you vouch for the $463.39 purchase on 229 at Lululemon? No, I don't habitually buy athleisure gear. Identity data is inextricable from traditional payment networks. This is because there are many layers between payments and final settlement. An incredibly large and profitable business exists to assess the credibility of transactors and facilitate deferred settlement transactions between them. This is because credibility and mutual trust enables massive efficiencies. You can lend your neighbor a lawnmower without demanding he provide a bond to cover its value because you trust him. Credit card networks just scale this up. They are trust underwriters, determining quantitatively how trustworthy I am and passing along those assurances to merchants with whom I transact. if they get it wrong, and it turns out I'm the kind of person who racks up a $10,000 credit card bill with no intention of ever paying, they swallow the cost. It was their bad. They should have done a better job assessing my trustworthiness. The contract you implicitly agree to when you use Bitcoin is between you and the protocol, not between you and all the other users of Bitcoin. The only trust required is users trusting that the cryptographic and economic assumptions hold. So far, they have. It has become trendy to denounce popular Bitcoiners as uncompromising, unreasonable assholes, and imply that there's something wrong with Bitcoin as a consequence, too. But Bitcoin is indifferent to this. It is a protocol for encoding and conveying value through a communications medium. Bitcoin isn't even aware of what the price of Bitcoin is, let alone the political trends of the day. It knows very, very little about itself. As stated above, Bitcoin is attractive and useful precisely because it rejects any identity data from the conditions required for a spend. The only thing that has to be furnished is knowledge of a private key corresponding to a public key. When you receive Bitcoin, you do not need to be aware of the identity of the sender because Bitcoin settles probabilistically. You can simply define your own threshold for finality, say requiring $500,000 of work to be done before you consider a transaction final. That would correspond to waiting, at current rates, for 4 to 5 blocks under which your transaction should be buried. This is what allows me to accept funds from people that I mistrust, and why Bitcoin is carving out a niche in these frontier transactions. Think of a ransomware hacker and his victim. These people mutually mistrust each other. The victim has been wounded and attacked, but the hacker still trusts that the $500 sent to them for the ransom in the form of Bitcoin is a valid, unlikely to be reversed payment. You may not like this, but Bitcoin flourishes on the margins of society. These are increasingly widening as banking becomes politicized and used as a political tool, as the U.S.-driven settlement system is co-opted for strategic objectives, and as identity requirements for payments networks become ever more rapacious. Transacting with people you have no reason to trust is precisely why Bitcoin exists. The internet allowed us to transact with people on the other side of the globe, but internet commerce is beset by fraud. The reason credit cards are expensive is because the cost of remediating fraud and chargebacks are socialized. If you aren't comfortable with evil people using Bitcoin, you should abandon it now. Of course, the jettisoning of counterparty trust and risk comes with some perceived drawbacks. Principal among them, you cannot evict someone from your network. This is very uncomfortable to people who believe that money ought to be a political tool to be exploited to disempower political foes of the day. There is a particular paradox in demanding that the members of a network you have inserted yourself into adhere to a certain moral code of conduct. As stated above, Bitcoin, and fast-settling hard money more generally, exist to facilitate commerce between individuals that do not have a pre-existing bond of trust. What did intercontinental traders use to transact in the 17th century? They certainly didn't use IOUs, wampum, collectibles, or credit relationships. They knew that they might never see each other again, so they used the hardest money they had available, gold and silver. Monetary metals speak for themselves. They are no one's liability. In this same way, Bitcoin is a means to transfer wealth between individuals who both have an interest in final settlement. It is not a means to establish a credit relationship, although Lightning is an early move in this direction. Bitcoin is deliberately amoral. It has no requirements to entry and asks nothing of the user aside from a valid signature. It facilitates commerce between people who explicitly disagree with each other. Thus, trying to impose a moral code on Bitcoin is contrary to its very nature. If everyone who used Bitcoin agreed with each other, then no one would need Bitcoin. They could all exchange IOUs backed by their mutual trust in each other. But because the world is messy and people disagree with each other, hard money is warranted. Our chaotic world practically demands it. So if you're the kind of person that rejects a useful transaction medium because someone you dislike is using it as well, it wasn't suited for you in the first place. Bitcoin is edgy precisely because the world needs a payments and savings system which cannot be interfered with on moral or political grounds. To repudiate these transactional constraints is to violate the carefully poised moral setting that has seized the West. If stepping out of line isn't for you, stick to PayPal instead. Bitcoin is an apocalyptic death cult. As Bitcoin hater-in-chief David Girard so elegantly puts it, Bitcoin is in fact an apocalyptic death cult. Apocalyptic because Bitcoiners recognize the futility of the current monetary system and appreciate that it is likely to end in tears. Death because states won't give up their monetary privilege easily. Bitcoin is veiled in eschatological overtones. Cult? Because you have to be somewhat deranged to take a pill this black. So, spare a thought for the Bitcoiners. They are fully awakened to the pending grief and strife that awaits us. Cassandra's warning governments and citizens alike to the disruptive effects of truly sovereign currency. Sovereign as in free, not as in state-owned. But unable most of the time to convince their fellow man that the state's monetary machinations may not be sound. Most people are content to surrender all freedom and autonomy to the Leviathan, as long as the pot they are in boils slowly. But it's open to all. The exact reason that Bitcoin is despised by so many. Identity, creditworthiness, and trust are irrelevant in this system, making it a fertile ground for criminals, is the exact reason why it's so inclusive. Unlike PayPal, Venmo, or traditional payment processors, it cannot deplatform you for wrongthink, holding subversive political views, being a sex worker, or legally selling cannabis. Ours is the biggest possible tent. Don't be distracted by the online discourse. Bitcoin is utterly indifferent to the political views of its users. Its core developers, the high priests of the protocol, can barely change it. Implementing a fairly routine upgrade, SegWit, took them years of cajoling and pleading. Getting it to do anything other than produce blocks, accept valid spins, resolve forks, and relentlessly march onward is virtually impossible. Whether Bitcoin will challenge the state, or whether that task will be left up to a successor, is yet to be determined. That the state's monetary privilege has been permanently eroded is evident, though. It died a little that day in January 2009 when the Chancellor was on the brink, and it has been shrinking ever since. By Nick Carter, October 2019. All right, let's hit our sponsor real quick, and then we can jump into Guy's take on this great piece. Doesn't Nick Carter just write the best stuff? And this is one of those concepts that is, in my opinion, irrefutable, is that the cat is literally out of the bag. Any degree of control or sense of restriction that can be put on any of these networks. I mean, again, we're talking about thousands of alternatives to the Bitcoin system that have copied and made some alteration or semblance of change or a specific direction from the original, from the Bitcoin system itself. The number, just the sheer number of whack-a-mole heads that, like, one would have to take out, whereas some are specifically meant to be in an attempt to be more subversive in some specific way, like Monero or something that wants to just solve the fact that every transaction has some semblance of privacy. even at the base layer, this thing is out of the bag. We are moving into a world where digital assets and digital currency is a thing. And I think everything points right now, all the economic incentive, all of the network effect, all of the true need, which Nick Carter always just puts so beautifully in this article, and it's the first, straight out the gate, first paragraph, what the world needed was a new monetary institution, and that is what Bitcoin is providing, entirely lacking of identity. It does not give a shit about anything except securing the monetary policy and ensuring that a valid signature is made in order to move any of the money within the system. There is no vetting, there is no trustworthiness, there are no credit scores. All of that can be handled by a market that wants to use trust where trust is needed, or where trust is, this is something that he brings up in this point. This is something that I remember, I think it's Jill Carlson who spoke about this at, I don't remember which conference, one of the conferences I went to. She had a really good speech about how we're constantly trying to engineer, design everything to be totally trustless, when in fact, what we, like Bitcoin and even the Lightning Network in some sense, serves that purpose when you don't have trust, when trust isn't there. But what we need to do is build systems of trust. What we need to do is figure out how to make that more efficient, because that's just like Nick Carter says, trust is something that gives us an unbelievable amount of efficiency. It allows us to skip all these unnecessary steps where if I know you, if we have a business relationship, there's no reason to use Bitcoin, or there's no reason to not necessarily use Bitcoin, but there's no reason to always have our transactions settle in such a way that we can't come to agreement about what was going on, that the Bitcoin is the arbiter. It's like going to court every time you and your wife want to make some change in your banking account or something like this. It's like, why do you need final settlement there when you're already just making an agreement like between each other, like with, you know, me and Starbucks? Like, that's one of those reasons why this isn't a payments network. The unbelievable potential and power of this protocol is where transactions and trust is lost between people, where you're bridging some sort of a divide. It's all about the social scalability argument, where you bridge a divide that could be as great as someone being hacked, as someone being as a victim and their perpetrator. Like, that's the best example, and I love that he uses that, even though you would think it's like the worst example for to prove the value of Bitcoin. Is that, like, wait, what? It empowers a criminal? It empowers a hacker and a criminal to get money from a victim? How terrible is that? But when you look at it from an idea of trust, when you look at it from an idea of how big the gap between those two people trusting it, like, they could not be further from hating each other in every possible way, but that the Bitcoin transaction is secure between them nonetheless. It's veritable proof of the unbelievable independence and indifference of the Bitcoin system, that it provides trust in every transaction and it does not give two shits as to who is there, who's involved with this transaction. Is the signature valid or is it not? We're done here. And in creating that system, it allows a solution. It allows an opt-out from this monetary issuance machine. I love that, like, the populist revolts he talks about, like all across the world today, we're seeing this over and over and over again, this same pattern repeat itself, and people are rising up and all being about socialism and evil capitalism, when the truth is that capitalism is not at fault here. This is the exact opposite of capitalism. The source of this incredible imbalance, of the Cantillon effect, of this huge redistribution of wealth to the financially connected, to the political class, is absolutely a form of industry socialism. That there's nothing that comes as close to socialism as our financial system and our monetary system. It is 100% monopolized by a single producer. all competition is explicitly and forcefully outlawed. Any competition whatsoever is met with jail time, fines. Like, I think Nothus, the guy who created the Liberty Dollar, which was just a dollar backed by actual gold in their Liberty Reserve, which seems like a completely reasonable thing. He wasn't trying in any sense whatsoever trying to claim that it was the U.S. dollar. That, in fact, just the opposite. It was sold and explained as a competitor that was better, that wasn't going to be inflation, that wasn't going to succumb to all the inflation and stupidity of the monetary policy of the U.S. government, was fined like $250,000, the tiny $7 million. That was the total amount of bills in gold that they had ever issued, $7 million as an institution, which is absolute peanuts. For if you just look at it in the grand scheme of things as to the amount of unbelievable, just flat out robbing and fraud that was done by the financial institutions and the interest rate controls and everything that went on during the early 2000s bubble and housing bubble and subprime nonsense, nobody went to prison. Nobody went to prison for trillions of dollars in fraud. This guy does $7 million. Pays multiple fines, sits in jail for like 3 or 4 years awaiting sentencing, and then gets 5 years on top of it all. And what was it for? Fraud and counterfeiting. Counterfeiting for a quote-unquote Liberty dollar that looked nothing like the U.S. dollar. You would have thought you were holding the euro. You were like, what the hell is this? It wasn't trying to mimic the U.S. dollar. But this was the quote from Maggie Tompkins, the United States attorney, when announcing the verdict. Quote, attempts to undermine the legitimate currency of this country are simply a unique form of domestic terrorism. While these forms of anti-government activities do not involve violence, they are every bit as insidious and represent a clear and present danger to the economic stability of this country. We are determined to meet these threats through infiltration, disruption, and dismantling of organizations which seek to challenge the legitimacy of our democratic form of government, end quote. That is her defense of someone competing with a product on the market. Explain to me how that is a free market. That is 100, there is nothing more socialist than that. That is the definition of socialism. The government owns a 100% unquestionable monopoly on the production of a good, on the production and market of a good. So the largest market in the entire economy by orders of magnitude, no comparison whatsoever, is 100% run by politics and a central institution, a single government-approved institution. Oh yeah, and what do? With the ability to produce this good solely and unto themselves, that they cage the nonviolent people who compete with them? Oh yeah, they use this privilege to control interest rates, to control and manipulate the price of time investment in the economy. I'm sorry, but anyone calling this system that we are under, regardless of the amount of freedom we have in buying TVs and phones, anyone trying to claim that this is capitalism is doing so out of utter and profound ignorance to what that word means. End of story. Okay, back to the article. The one thing I didn't, that I thought was really neat that Nick Carter put in here, I've never really quite looked, I mean, I'm sure I've stumbled upon this in the past, but the velocity of the M2 money stock, that chart, which if you want to go check that out, I recommend it. If you know the whole velocity, the equation of exchange, if you know the MV equals PQ, this paints a really interesting picture of basically what's been going on. And we've talked about this actually at the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup, because we got a couple guys there in particular, is really knowledgeable about this stuff. And we've just talked about, like, how is it that we don't have the incredible amount of consumer good inflation that you would expect to have? And the simple fact of the matter is that it's the money is being given to such a small subset, it's accessible to such a small subset that what they're able to do is just use it to, in a circular way, to give money back to themselves. They're essentially investing in their own assets. So it becomes this huge circular way of just focusing all of the inflation into the prices of the assets that they are holding on to. So the closer they are to the monetary spigot, that all these asset prices skyrocket in value. And while consumer prices don't go up, you see everything closest to these assets go up. You see the massive amount, like the financial instruments, the debts that back all of these other services and stuff in the economy. The renting class pays unbelievably high rents. The cost of living continues to go up. The cost of healthcare is skyrocketing. The cost of education, backed by it's like 99% debt, fuels the education system. And it's all debt that's government-backed and issued and subsidized by a single institution that controls the money supply and determines what the interest rate is on all of this money. Again, a perfect example of socialism destroying a market for a good. Education is a nightmare of high prices and corruption because the government determines where the money comes for the whole damn thing. What we need is a new monetary institution. We need the Liberty Dollar that can actually compete against it. We need something that, as Hayek said, we will never have a good money again before we take it out of government. We can't violently take it from them. We just need a sly, roundabout way to introduce something that they can't stop. That is what we need. We need the denationalization and the decentralization of the monetary institution. And frankly put, the cat is out of the bag. We did it. We did it the first time, and whether or not, and Nick Carter's right, as much as I totally believe that Bitcoin is the one, that it's our absolute best chance, that maybe it will be a successor. Maybe there will be another thing that solves that problem, but the simple fact of the matter is that we figured out how to do it once, and now we have a huge community that, even if Bitcoin failed, I would go nowhere. I would immediately be like, all right, where did it fail? Why did it fail? Who was the adversary that it couldn't stand up against? How do we solve this problem? And I think there would be an explosion. I don't think this community, I think the amount of diehard cypherpunk that is now out there is orders of magnitude higher than it ever was. There are more people who care about and understand the need for exactly this sort of thing than ever before in the history of the world, hands down, no questions asked. And that, in and of itself, is the cat is out of the bag. There's no going back from that, because none of those people, myself included, will ever not care about solving this problem, regardless of what happens to Bitcoin. We took the red pill, and there is no going back into the matrix. And what's funny, for the people who don't see that, or the ones who misappropriate what the role that Bitcoin plays in this, which is just an indifferent protocol. It just sitting there working consistently. It's funny, and I'll just go ahead and read the quote because I love it. It has become trendy to denounce popular Bitcoiners as uncompromising, unreasonable assholes and imply that there is something wrong with Bitcoin as a consequence too. But Bitcoin is indifferent to this. It is a protocol for encoding and conveying value through a communications medium. Bitcoin isn't even aware of what the price of Bitcoin is, let alone the political trends of the day. It knows very, very little about itself. End quote. And you'll notice this. Watch very closely. All the communities that are just crazy butthurt about Bitcoin continuing to exceed expectations, to succeed. The real butthurt Ethereans, and now not to say that everybody in Ether, in Ethereum, is like this. I mean, there are plenty of people who are just, you know, there for an alternative and like the ideas and just don't shit on Bitcoin maximalists all day. But there are a number of them that do. So this is just a generalization for anybody who's trying really hard to be offended here. But more specifically, look at the forks. Look at the forks of Bitcoin, those who are explicitly there. I mean, Bitcoin Cash is almost universally, the entire philosophical foundation is just that Bitcoin is the devil. If Bitcoin ever turns out to not be the devil, not be the CIA, well, then Bitcoin Cash is done, because they have invested so much in the fact that Bitcoin is a corporate takeover. They cannot allow themselves to believe any tiny amount of the fact that Bitcoin is actually just an alternative engineering method. They have to be evil. It's got to be Greg Maxwell took over Bitcoin and Adam Back made the miners sign a secret backdoor agreement, and it's got to be a CIA conspiracy. Roger Ver today dropped about that, used Richard Hart as an example of proof that Bitcoin is like the CIA and based on lying, cheating, and stealing. I just watched that video. I'm like, what? You are losing it, man. I think it's like Mr. Holdall posted that. I just could not. I was like, are you kidding me? Richard Hart. He's the most obnoxious scammer, which Roger Ver proudly listed on Bitcoin.com. He promoted Richard Hart's bullshit scam coin. What the fuck? Anyway, but the whole point is how much all of them lean on just attacking of personalities. It's this person did it. It's look at the evil person. I can't tell you how many conversations I have had about the underpinnings of whether or not a network could survive by running over Tor, whether or not big blocks are a trade-off, whether or not you are getting full validation by running an SPV node, and whether or not you're actually just relying on someone else to prove the inflation schedule for you, that you're just going to trust them, that they checked all the work. Conversations about whether Bitcoin private was a perfect example of how hard forks are the attack vector, and that not validating the supply is the perfect way to get screwed by someone who's inflating the currency by 3 million hidden coins. And they link me to a Reddit conversation that Greg said something stupid. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like, let me show you this Blockstream conspiracy. Look at this conversation we got off of Telegram with Adam Back. And I'm like, none of this is remotely related. Is that all you have? You just have to attack? There is nothing that Bitcoin does not give two shits about any of this. Bitcoin doesn't care about a Telegram chat. Bitcoin has no idea Reddit exists. Bitcoin does not care about anyone or anything that is outside the purview of its protocol. Anyway, that's just something to think about. If they can't stay on topic, and that's one thing I try so hard to do, is to argue and something that's arguable. You know, like when you're attacking when you attack somebody's conversation, literally what you are saying is that your evidence is someone else's intent, which is something that no one can know. You are trying to get evidence from hundreds of thousands of conversations on Reddit and the internet and on Twitter and all sorts of things. Grab this line, and this line out of context or in context, who gives a shit, and trying to say that this is the intent of the person that you are talking about, and that their intent is thus the intent of Bitcoin, which is stupid. I'm sorry that that's not very nice, but it is. It's just stupid. It's bad logic. It's bad argumentation. It has nothing to do with anything. And Bitcoin is not going to adhere to the regulations. Bitcoin is not about being flowery and inclusive. Like, whatever. I mean, that's a good goal for the community. That's good for if we want to, you know, get other people in, and we want to, foster some sort of an environment, sure. But this has nothing to do with Bitcoin. Do that all day on your Twitter sphere or in your social circles. I'm nice to everyone who tells me I'm an idiot for investing in Bitcoin. I'm not mad about it. I don't really care. I was promoting Bitcoin in 2011. I have seen all of the faces of people who look at me like a sad little child who's going to lose all their money or is investing in a Ponzi scheme, or that look that you get when, you know, it feels like you're trying to sell somebody Amway. So I just smile and be like, I understand that you get that. As an outsider looking in, Bitcoin does look pretty absurd. So I'm okay with that. But the whole point of this is that if we could enforce a moral code, if we could enforce that everyone was nice, and we knew that that was always going to be the case, and that we could foster a community around exactly that, we would never need Bitcoin. We would never need Bitcoin. We could just know that all of the community was going to be nice, and everybody is going to get along, and just like Nick Carter said, we could just exchange a bunch of IOUs backed by our mutual trust in each other. But guess what? The world is messy. People disagree. People are shitty to each other. Hard money is necessary to overcome these gaps, to build bridges across social barriers, across cultural barriers, across government jurisdictions. It is back to the money blockchains and social scalability of Nick Szabo, is that it's explicitly because of those massive barriers that disallow us to trust each other, that make us unsure of the other party in the trade, that maybe we'll never trade with them ever again. How could we have an independent medium with which we could trust that instead of having to trust each other? And Bitcoin, by evidence of the fact that scammers and hackers and criminals have used it and continue to do so, is proof of exactly that characteristic, of exactly that level of inclusion. It doesn't care about anything. It is the only, I love that it just says, ours is the biggest tent. It is the one tent that can encompass literally everyone who has access to a computer. And in a world where money and banking are becoming a political weapon, the need for this thing is greater than it has ever been. And that's one of those things that just likens sheds light on the sort of prophetic seeming nature of Bitcoin, that it landed just when it was so badly needed. And Carter brings it up in this piece that, had it landed in the 90s, would it have really been, would anyone have understood? Like, what if it went for 3-4 years and people just shut off their machines, you know? Who would have seen really the value in it outside of the 20 cypherpunks or whatever at the time that were on that mailing list? So it is pretty powerful that it happened exactly when it did and presented an incredible alternative to the absurdity of monetary socialism that has encompassed the entire world. And how lucky are we that this thing is even here? So with that, this was The Cat is Out of the Bag by Nick Carter. Another one in the amazing set of articles in the Bitcoin Times, second edition from the Amber, the crew at the Amber app, and Alexander Svetsky. So do not forget to follow all of these people. I will have links to all this stuff in the show notes so you don't miss any other articles or the next editions of the Bitcoin Times, because this is just wonderful stuff. I love it every time. And this one's only better than the last one, so it's exciting to see what they're going to do going forward. And of course, Nick Carter. If you don't listen to On the Brink, you got to do that. It's becoming one of my favorite podcasts here, and I'm always reading Nick Carter's work, so that is definitely something to check out, and I'll throw that in the show notes as well, just because. But that will close us out. Thank you guys so much for listening. This is The Cryptoeconomy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, turning all the best work into the audio version it deserves so that all you guys who don't have time to read all of it, you can listen. You can listen to the Cryptoeconomy podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss anything else. The amazing work that is going on in this space. There's a lot of like updates and a couple of really fun technical things that I want to get to. There's another really good piece on Bitcoin Magazine that I kind of want to cover here in the next couple of days as we finish out the Bitcoin Times here. And we got one last piece tomorrow by their founder, Alexander Svetsky, and it's going to be a good one, so don't miss it. Subscribe to the show. And if you want to support my work in the autification of all things Bitcoin and the crypto economy, become a patron on patreon.com. As little as a dollar a month will get you into the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram group, where we talk about all this stuff. And I made some changes to the website, so if you haven't checked that out, there's a lot of great new stuff up there, and I'm finally getting together. I've been working on the back end to put all the tags and the categories and all this stuff for 400 episodes of this show. I've been doing this for months now, and I finally think I've got a workflow and a system worked out, and it's been going way, way easier and flowing better than it has since I got the damn thing up. So check it out. That's thecryptoeconomy.com. Lots of new stuff. We've got the Unchained Capital Collection, so if you want to check out their blog, we've got a bunch of their writing now in audio. So check that out at thecryptoeconomy.com. And of course, if you want to be a part of the Telegram crew, become a patron at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. And lastly, the one way that everybody can support this show is by sharing it out with your friends, everyone you know who's been interested and wanted to check out the Bitcoin rabbit hole but never really took that dive. Everybody you know in the Bitcoin space who doesn't know that they can get all the best articles in audio, who can get access to all this stuff and hear Guy's take, which is definitely the best part of this whole show. So share that out with everybody. And I will catch you all next time on the Crypto Economy. Thank you so much. And until then, take it easy, guys.